poet, editor, essayist, anthologist, biographer. Harry Ricketts has just published his 11th collection of poems called Winter Eyes. He teaches English literature, creative writing, Victoria University, Professor Ricketts. And one of his series of poems in this latest book has been hugely popular on the spin-off. It was the Friday poem on the spin-off website. Much to his surprise, says Harry.
Yes. Much to my surprise. Hi.
Why are you surprised?
I think you write things and for whatever purposes, and then you assume that maybe a few people will read them or come across them, and occasionally it coincidentally happens that you write something that touches a chord or a nerve, which is what seems to have happened with this one. So
the thing about grief limericks is that it's a subversion of the form, right? Limericks are usually funny.
Yeah.
Grief limerick sounds oxymoronic.
Yeah, that's right. I wish I could say that I, you know, kind of invented the idea. It was another Wellington poet, Nick Ascroft, who wrote five limericks of grief a few years ago for his father. And although I wasn't deliberately copying this, you know, I had read them, you know, they were churning around in the back of my mind. So this is a poem that's part of a sequence about my late stepson, Max. And one day, I think I was in a meeting, and this line, "I once had a stepson called Max," just came into my head. And it sounded like the beginning of a limerick.
Can you read us some?
Yes. So there are five of them. So if you don't mind, I'll read them all, because they're like a little sort of potted history of our relationship. I once had a stepson called Max. As a child, he could rarely relax. The other kids kicked him. He was a natural victim. I once had a stepson called Max. I once had a stepson called Max, light gun and blood on the tracks. But things were askew, were tangled in blue. I once had a stepson called Max. I once had a stepson called Max with needs as tender as wax. When I left his mother, he saw me as other. I once had a stepson called Max. I once had a stepson called Max whose memories turned into tacks. Love inside out helps hatred to sprout. I once had a stepson called Max. I once had a stepson called Max with a head full of cricketing facts, who one winter's day... I once had a stepson called Max.
So that's a heartbreaker.
I haven't read that aloud.
I don't...
aloud before.
Yeah. I don't want to excavate beneath that poem. But it was hard wrought, was it not?
It was hard wrought in a strange way. Having this weirdly inappropriate form was kind of a help. I don't know, you know, how to. That might seem strange, but in fact, trying to make the form work, because limericks, everybody thinks limericks are easy, but actually they're harder than they might seem. You have to get the rhythm right. You have to get the metre right, and the rhyme. Although, in that one, I repeated the first line. That's what Edward Lear, who invented the limerick form, the first and the fifth line is always the same, and it seemed to me for an elegy, you know, that's a kind of elegy, a refrain worked better than having a different line.
Yeah, it's like a ballad.
It is a bit like a ballad. That's right. And it keeps coming back to, I once had a stepson called Max, but I don't have one anymore.
There's a putative limerick that's been in my head about you and cricket. I have no doubt that a better poet than I has made one up about you and cricket.
Yeah, you can do cricket and you can do wicket. And possibly other things too, yes.
You're big on form. You've got, as you explain in the back of this collection, triolets. Do you say triolets?
Yep, triolets, yeah. Now, I have this very good Australian poet friend called Kath Fidler, and she's actually a very experimental poet, but she knows that I'm kind of interested in forms, and so periodically she would say, why don't you try this? And so...
So what's a triolet?
A triolet is one of those repetitive forms where it's a very short form, 8 lines with of which 3 of them get 3 lines get repeated and 2 other ones, you know, so you only have to make up a few lines.
What's the benefit of repetition for
you? The benefit of repetition, and this is even more the case with villanelles, is that they're very good for expressing cyclical feeling stuck, you know, those kind of things.
Have you got a triolet in Winter Eyes?
I have got...
Is Winter Eyes a Schubert pun?
I don't know. Could be.
As in Winterreiser.
Winterreiser. Well, bad German speaker, but I do speak some German. There's a poem in here about a German novel that we read when I was at school years ago called Zanzibar oder der letzte Grund. I'm pretty keen on German literature, actually.
You're denying that it's a Schubert pun.
But I don't know that it was a Schubert pun.
Why do you call it Winter Eyes, then?
Well, it came at the end of this poem, Zanzibar oder der letzte Grund, actually, as it happens. And it was a poem that's a poem that begins in Wellington, and then I'm looking at the harbour, and it reminds me of other things. That's often what happens in these poems. And then it comes back to the harbour, and the harbour's changed. It was very shiny. It was like a shield being shone off the water, and then it's gone all grey. And for some reason, I just got the line, things look different through winter eyes. I don't know, just came into my head.
Anyway, I interrupted you. You're on the hunt. You're on the hunt for a triolet?
A villanelle.
Oh, villanelle?
Yeah, so this is... there are a couple of villanelles in here. I tend to do them in a slightly irregular kind of way. So you get the repeated lines, but I muck around with the rest of it. This is one called Dumper and Co.
This one predated, I need to tell people, it predated the blockbuster movie The Breaker Upper.
It did, by several years.
I think you could probably claim some of the profits of that. I'm sure they got the idea from this.
Of course. I mean, this was also in the spin-off, this one. So they must have read it, mustn't they? Yeah. It came up on Saturday mornings. Friends and I and my wife Belinda, we play ping-pong. And this poem came out of a post-ping-pong conversation.
Did you know that ping-pong is supposed to be racist now?
Oh, no.
Sorry to break the news. You're not allowed to call it ping-pong. Right. You have to call it table tennis.
Table tennis, right.
I'm sorry. Because ping-pong's onomatopoeic, right?
It is, yes.
So,
and it's like,
as a poet, I can understand
like
why
the
you...
game.
Yep.
All right, that word will never cross my lips again.
That's a shame.
Anyway, we had this idea, what if there was a firm which specialised in handling relationship breakups? How might they advertise themselves? How might they promote themselves? So that's the kind of genesis for the poem. Dumper and Co. Having trouble with your relationship? You may or may not be to blame. Don't delay. Contact Dumper and Co. today. Does he or she play home and away? Suspect them of being bi, straight or gay? Having trouble with your relationship? Some like it cold, some hot. Discretion guaranteed. Or not. Don't delay. Contact Dumper & Co. today. The little thing's big, that's what they say. Her laugh, his gobbledygoo. Are you sleeping with someone with more problems than you? Having trouble with your relationship? We understand it can be hard to unclip. Let us handle all the hullabaloo. Don't delay. Contact Dumper & Co. today. A letter, a phone call, an email, a tweet. Ron could pay a little visit. Having trouble with your relationship? Don't delay. Contact Dumper & Co. today.
Yeah, copyright on that. So what makes that a villanelle?
What makes that a villanelle is that the first and the third line of the first verse become recurring refrain lines.
Having trouble with your relationship.
That's right.
And don't delay.
Yeah.
Contact Dumper and Co today.
And it sort of irregularly rhymes, just because that's kind of fun and...
So I take it from all the names of these triolets and villanelles that they're made up by some arty French type.
But not tritinas. This friend, Kath, also got me off on tritinas.
Which is 10 lines with the three end words in changing order.
That's right, exactly. So they're like a kind of teen sestina, as I come to think of them. And they were made up quite recently. I thought they must be an old form, but they're not. They were made up quite recently by an American poet called Marie Ponsot. And she said that they were the square root of the sestina, which is very witty.
I'm not surprised that you love all this because of your love for cricket. It's all a bit crickety, isn't it?
It's all a bit crickety, yeah. Yes, perhaps it is, right. Yes.
So what have you got for a triolet for us?
A triolet...
Are we talking about triolets or tritinas?
Tritinas. But what I like to try and do with these is again, to have unexpected content in them, so that triolets became a kind of another of those comic forms, and you know, English poets like Wendy Cope have written fantastically funny triolets. But what happens if you skew them a bit and put in stuff that you don't normally expect to find there?
And the funniness of them, I'm imagining, comes from. The funniness of limericks comes from your expectation of that next word, may suddenly be twisted.
And so it's sort of like kind of, the idea is that the kind of firm footing slides under your feet. Mm. You know, so here's a triolet, it's called Humpbacked Moon. This thin plotted pantomime must always end too soon. There'll be time, we say, there'll be time to rewrite our part in the pantomime, to embrace the promise of the approaching rhyme, to feed our gaze on this humpbacked moon, eerily rising on this pantomime, which must always send too soon.
Nah. That's a bit T.S. Eliot as well, isn't it?
It is a bit T.S. Eliot, yes. Well,
Did you do a thing? You didn't do your master's... No, you did your master's on Kipling.
That's right.
But T.S. Eliot must have been a big influence on you back in the day when you were at Oxford.
Yeah, and there was a teacher at school who was mad about Eliot and got us to read Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock and The Wasteland when we were 16, 17. Mm. And he was one of those teachers who probably wouldn't get a job now because he wasn't qualified, but he was qualified in all the really important ways. He was a great enthusiast, and you just got caught up on the wings of his enthusiasm. You know, he was wonderful, lovely person.
You forget that T.S. Eliot was so astonishing.
Oh, yes.
Because everybody else used to rhyme, right?
And Prufrock rhymes, of course. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky, like a patient he thrives upon a table. But he rhymes in weird ways.
Yeah.
The other thing was, you know, I still am, you know, I'm mad about Dylan and Bob Dylan. And his rhymes are wonderful. You know, he's endlessly surprising with his rhymes. Mm. So it's not everybody's cup of tea, but, you know, you can sing a broken song. That's not a bad thing to do.
That's why poetry must be so difficult to translate, because it's so particular on the sound.
Yes, that's right. And the references, and it's not translation's not a clear medium, you know. The poets who translate, interestingly, the poets who translate sort of best, as it were, like Byron, the wit manages to kind of transfer, but his language isn't very dense. Do you see what I mean? It's a tone of voice, and people have successfully managed to render that tone of voice into other languages. But you know, lots of the poets, you can't do that because there's no equivalent, or what you get is a new poem. That's the thing. Is you get a different poem.
Do you read poems in translation?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I did years of Latin at school, but I can't read it properly. So
What, you can only speak it?
Hick, hike, hock.
Mea culpa.
Yeah, mea culpa, right, no.
You're off the hook on ping pong, by the way, I'm informed. That more accurately, it's called ping pong. Q-I-U, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. And that's the Mandarin word for table tennis. Oh. So it's not racist.
It's not racist.
So you can carry on calling it ping pong.
Gosh, I've just had a really bad 10 minutes, but it's all gone
now.
No,
I'm glad to be the news bearer on that one. So who do you read in translation?
I read people like Ovid and Horace, and I read a certain amount of Chinese poetry in translation. I read some German poetry in translation, although I can read a bit of German.
Latin would seem to be the least poetic language somehow.
Well, I'm persuaded by friends of mine who are classicists that this is not the case. I have one very good friend who's an English poet who's you know, his idea of a good time is to be walking around with Virgil and Homer in the original. But he said a very, since I mentioned him, I might interject this. He said a very good thing to me years and years ago, which is I've always remembered, and I think is kind of what quite a lot of my poems are trying to do or register. Which is, he said to me, the present is the moving edge of the past. The present is the moving edge of the past, and I thought, oh, I wish I'd thought of that, but I've always remembered it. And the more I think about it, the more I think it's true that we're living both on, you know, the edge of the world's past, but we're living on the edge of our own past, increasingly our own past, you know. And I think I'm really grateful for him saying that to me. I think it's kind of helped me in various ways.
A lot of your poems are elegies.
Yes.
In
a way. A lot of these ones are, yeah, that's true.
Is that something to do with the fact that you've lived in so many different places?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I think it probably is.
You were a military brat.
Yeah, I was one of those kind of fag end of empire brats. That's what a friend of mine used to call us. So when I was born, I was born in London, but then we moved to Malaysia, then we moved to England, then we moved to Hong Kong. You know, we just kind of ricocheted around.
When you say we, I mean, you spent most of your childhood in boarding school, didn't you?
From 8 to 18. But wow. We'd already moved a lot before that.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it does strange things to you. Different people have very different experiences of their schools, of course.
Did you have a George Orwell experience?
Such were the joys. Well, that's one of my favourite essays.
Yeah.
Absolutely hits home.
Does it?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a Latin master at that school who was very tyrannical, and we used to sit in the dining room in prep, and he would go round on green carpet slippers very softly, and he had this strange smell in his breath, and I worked out later it was whiskey. I didn't know what whiskey smelt like when I was there. And he would go and everybody would kind of jolt in their seats, and he had particular phrases. You intolerable little mountebank, he would say. He was terrifying.
Still, good grasp of the English language.
Good grasp of the English language, and good fodder. I mean, you know, if you survive, then these things become usable. But you've got to survive, of course.
It's been something to do with the Latin. We had a Latin teacher called Mr. Cambridge, whom we called Cabbage. He's passed away now, and I say it with all respect because I quite liked him. But he also smelt of, I don't know whether it was whiskey, but it was certainly some spiritous liquor of some description. Yes. Maybe that's what Latin does to a person. So, you emerged from boarding school and went, what, straight to Oxford?
Yeah, I went to Oxford from there. Yeah.
Was that good? Dreaming spires? Not so much.
It was. I did a lot of falling in love with people.
Oh.
I mean,
happily?
Not on the whole, no. But interestingly. And I made some good friends who are still friends.
So, what brought you to New Zealand in 1981?
A job.
Simple as that? You didn't pine for...
Well, I'd had a, I had a godmother who's my mother's oldest friend who lived here in the 50s, and she used to send me things. She used to send me those... You now get them in very thin versions, but those thick rulers with different woods in them.
Oh, yeah.
And she sent me books about ones that wouldn't pass muster now, but at the time were interesting. Wonder Tales of Maryland, you know, those kind of those kind of books. So I had a kind of sense of New Zealand being an interesting place. She'd lived here and she, you know, she'd liked it. And Thatcher had just got in England, and I had a family, and I thought, this is going to be a ghastly place, you know, to bring up children.
Was that apparent in 81?
It was. It was.
Because I think the Falkland War was just about to break out.
That's right. That was, we'd come here by then. I arrived, and the Springbok tour was happening, and I thought, gosh, this is a radical place, which, of course, it was.
You know, it would have seemed very radical.
Yeah, very radical.
And only 5 years later, you were producing a book comprising 12 New Zealand poets in conversation.
Right.
I say only 5 years later. I mean, 5 years is quite a long time. But yeah. To get to grips with a literary, I don't know, situation, I was going to say tradition, but we haven't got that long a tradition.
Yeah, probably there is now, though. I'm not sure there was then.
No. I mean, you'd very quickly become interested in the poetry being written here.
Yes, yeah, I did. I was lucky enough to be a colleague of Bill Manhar's and was reading him very assiduously. Ian Weddy, Loris Edmund, Cilla McQueen was starting to publish. Kernow, of course, was, you know, that extraordinary kind of juggernaut was still producing kind of fantastic poems. It was, and gosh, now how much more, kind of a sort of lively poetry scene. There was a lot going on.
In answer to the question, you addressed this yourself in the preface, I think, to 12 New Zealand Poets, in an interview with yourself that you did.
Oh, yeah.
shouldn't a New Zealander have done this?
Yeah.
You said, well, they didn't, did they? Mm. A plus... An outsider has an advantage?
Yeah, I think, this is a long time ago, Kim.
Still feel like an outsider? That's, I suppose, what I'm getting to.
Well, inside and outside. I'm now married to a New Zealander. That makes a huge difference.
When's your birthday?
Monday.
Oh, this Monday.
Yes. Shouldn't have let that out, should I?
Do you... Happy birthday for Monday, Harry.
Thank you.
Do you think that you have a birthday in the summer or the winter? Quickly.
Winter.
Yeah. You must be a New Zealander now.
I do now. It used to be in the summer.
Yeah.
That was...
Because that's the imprint, right?
Yes.
Seasons are imprinted on
you. Yeah, that's right.
You.
Yes.
Although... As you say, you moved around a lot.
I get very confused about these things, and I think my English friends think I sound like a New Zealander, and New Zealand friends think I sound English. So, yeah.
Not only poetry, as I said, you have written biography. You've written a book called Strange Meetings: The Poets of the Great War. Brooke and Sassoon and Graves and Owen. I meant to ask you because I was flipping through it the other day. We all remember Sassoon and Graves and Brooks
and Owen.
But not Robert Nichols.
But not Robert Nichols. Well
who
spotted.
Who was huge.
Oh, yes.
In 1917 and instantly anthologised.
Yep.
Who the hell is he now?
Yeah, well, 100 years ago, we'd all know, here as well as everywhere, we'd all know about Robert Nichols because the Times Literary Supplement had pigeonholed him for immortality.
Is it clear to you why he didn't become immortal?
Yes, I think it is. Because the book that made him famous, briefly, told a story that people wanted to hear. It was the War as Redemption story, and that was a very consoling story at the time. It was told, you could find versions of it in Australian poetry, C.J. Dennis was doing a similar kind of thing. Brooke had sort of started that. You know, you get redeemed by merging yourself in this larger whole.
If there is some corner of a foreign land.
That's right. It seems weird to us now, but probably because Owen has become top poet. He's the top war poet and has been since the 60s. Wasn't before that, but has since the 1960s been top war poet. And Dulce et Decorum Est is probably top war poem, you know. Everybody knows that. But back then, people were looking for consolation and a story, a poem sequence that suggested that there was something ennobling, there was something sustaining, some trans, you know, uplifting, etc. These were consoling chords to strike.
But a sentiment fell out of style.
Well, quite quickly. His story is a fascinating one because he survived the war and he'd had his 15 minutes or so in the sunlight and he spent the rest of his life, 25 years, trying to get back in there. He went to Hollywood. He was a scriptwriter for Douglas Fairbanks, senior. He gets a small credit on The Black Pirate. He wrote a play about splitting the atom just at the time that it was happening and had a momentary success, but then it faded. He did various things. He was in Yeats's now notorious anthology of modern verse.
Why is it notorious?
It's partly notorious because he was he wouldn't have Wilfred Owen in it. He said passive suffering is not a subject for poetry.
Oh.
And that Owen was all blood and sucked sugar stick.
Wow.
Mm.
That's Yeatsian, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very Yeatsian. But 30 years later, Owen's everywhere.
Yeah.
So he's in The War Requiem, you know, he's in anthologies. There were very influential anthologies in the 60s. His letters are published, a new edition of his poems. Suddenly, he's the one. The Vietnam War's going on. Protest poetry is suddenly very big. And he's fantastic, of course. So, you know, he's being, you know, in poetry readings, people are reading kind of Ginsberg or their, you know, kind of rallies. They're reading Ginsberg, they're reading Roger McGough, they're reading Adrian Mitchell, and they're reading Owen.
Yeah. You seem to have a soft spot for people whose sentiments have gone out of fashion. I'm thinking of Kipling as well. You wrote the biography of Kipling, The Unforgiving Minute. And, you know, Kipling was a terrible old imperialist.
He was other things too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. And I would say I had a love-hate thing with Kipling, not pure adulation. But he was a fascinating writer, you know, and for everything that you can chalk up, no, I can't take this, there's another thing which you think, that's really interesting. So, for instance, you know, he's in the First World War, his son is killed, and he becomes completely from a poetry point of view, schizophrenic. He's writing poems against the Germans, and he's writing these really moving poems about parents who lose their children. And also, you know, two lines, which are brilliant, I think. It's a two-line poem. If any question why we died, tell them because our fathers lied. And he's one of the lying fathers.
Mm.
So, you know, he's interesting.
Will you read us one last poem, please, Harry Ricketts? Oh, somebody sent me a limerick, by the way. There once was a man named Ricketts who had a passion for cricket, so he spun all his lines in keeping with times and ended up taking a wicket. Not bad.
Not bad. Thank you. Thank you. I might read you a poem about my mum, because there are a number of poems in here which are a kind of conversations with my mother, who was once a very articulate person, but now can't get intelligibly through a sentence. So, so this is called Room 10. So she's in a home in Karori, Room 10.
Will she be listening?
Almost certainly not. She doesn't know how to turn on the radio.
Okay.
You look asleep when I tiptoe in, but your eyes flick open as I pull a chair across. I reach for your hand, your fingers tissue soft, stroking mine. The wind tugs the curtain through the door which leads onto the inner courtyard. The sunlight reminds me suddenly of your garden, sitting on the lawn. It's hot. You're drinking Lapsang Souchong, trying that way you have to find out whether I'm serious about S, whom neither of us name. It's quiet. I light a cigarette to evade further questions. You sip your tea. But now you're mumbling something, something. Then, and quite distinctly, it's lovely. It's all right, I say. It's all right. Your fingers, tissue soft, stroke mine.
Thank you, Harry.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in, and thank you for the readings, and the best of luck with the book.
Thank you.
Winter Eyes, Harry Ricketts.